Hey, true crime fans. I'm Christina, and I'm the host of the podcast Cold Traces, an advocacy and investigation podcast for cold cases. Each season, I investigate one cold case by talking to the family and friends of an unsolved murder victim and to other cold case experts and advocates.
I've compared it to a backpack of bricks that I strapped on when he was killed.
There's a lot of questions that need to be asked that, you know, weren't asked.
This season, I'm investigating the mysterious murder of David Cox. David's time in the Marine Corps was the inspiration for the hit movie A Few Good Men, and shortly after the movie came out, David was mysteriously murdered execution style, and his killer has never been identified. Join me as I speak to those who knew David best. Subscribe to Cold Traces now on your favorite podcast app.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for all listeners. There may also be some explicit language used. I'd like to emphasize that this episode deals with violence against children and sexual assault. Listener discretion is strongly advised. On a side note, I usually try to cover lesser-known cases, but I am, of course, interested in historical cases as well. The Eastburn family murders are infamous because the trials of Timothy Hennis are very controversial. Legal scholars don't even agree. So fair warning, you will get my opinion, and for what it's worth, I don't have a law degree, it is just my opinion. Fayetteville, North Carolina is the home of Fort Bragg, a United States military base named for the Confederate General Braxton Bragg. It is the largest military installation in the world, with more than 50,000 active duty personnel. So Fort Bragg can feel like a small city unto itself, and the surrounding towns a suburb of the busy base. In 1985, Captain Gary Eastburn and his family, wife Catherine, known as Katie, along with their daughters Kara, Erin, and baby Jana, lived in Fayetteville at 367 Summerhill Road, about 10 minutes from the base. Captain Eastburn had recently been promoted to liaison to the British Air Force. But first, he had to attend a 3-month training course at the Air Force Officers School in Montgomery, Alabama, regretfully leaving Katie and the girls alone in Fayetteville. Gary and Katie had a strong and loving 10-year marriage, and they wrote each other often. They had a time set up every Saturday morning for Katie to call him at the base, since it was cheaper than him calling home collect. On Saturday, May 11th, the phone never rang. He gave it about 15 minutes and called himself, but there was no answer. He was due to be on a company run that morning, but had to leave and started calling again at 11 a.m. as soon as he got back. By 2:30, he was frantic. He called a friend at his home base and had them call the sheriff's department. The sheriff's deputy knocked on the Eastburns' door but got no answer. He left a note instructing Katie to call as soon as she could. He then awakened her neighbor, Bob Seafelt, and asked him if he had heard anything strange next door. And Seafelt, groggy and irritated by the flashlight shining in his eyes, said no. The next day was Mother's Day, May 12, 1985. And now Bob Seafelt glanced worriedly next door and noticed that 3 newspapers were piled up in the front yard. Sergeant Bob Seafelt knew Katie Eastburn and her daughters well. He had just seen her the Thursday evening before when she'd come over to borrow some milk. He had noticed Saturday that Katie's station wagon hadn't moved, but she had mentioned the last time they saw her that she might take the girls to visit their father in Montgomery. So he assumed they had taken the bus. Now he was remembering that late-night knock, and the eerie stillness of this Mother's Day had him worried. He went over and knocked on the side door, but no one answered. Then he rang the front doorbell and thought he heard Jana, the Eastburn's 20-month-old baby. He hollered for his wife, who called the Eastburn's longtime babysitter, Julie Zerniak, in the sheriff's office, and a child neglect dispatch went out at 12:53 p.m. Julie, the babysitter, beat Officer William Toman, who responded to the sheriff's department call. She could see Jana standing in her crib and asked why no one was going in to get her. Deputy Toman was trying to follow procedure, but after peering in a window and seeing Jana for himself, he sliced open the screen and pulled up the window. He stuck his head through and smelled the unmistakable stench of death. Little Jana Eastburn was pale, gaunt, eyes swollen from crying, but alive. Doctors would later say she wouldn't have lasted but another couple of hours. She clung to Toman's neck as he pulled her out of the crib. He handed her through the window to Bob Seafelt, along with a stack of diapers and a bottle he found neatly set by the crib. Toman pulled out his gun and began his search, with the smell getting stronger with each step. He first stopped in the master bedroom and found 3-year-old Erin Eastburn lying beside her parents' bed with a pillow leaning on her face. Her throat had been slashed to the point that her head was nearly severed. He walked around the bed and found her mother, Katie, bound, bloody, and nude. She also had a pillow over her face, and when he moved the pillow, he found her throat had been slashed in the same manner as Erin's, and she'd also been viciously stabbed in the chest. Toman walked out to the living room and saw some signs of a struggle, but not much. Katie's shoes, still tied, were in the middle of the floor, and her pink blouse was crumpled next to them. By now, the chief of paramedics was on scene to declare the obvious. Nothing but death was left in this house. Toman had walked outside and fell to the ground gagging, and asked if everyone was accounted for. When Bob Seafelt told him there were 3 children, Toman groaned and ran back in the house. He quickly found 5-year-old Kara Eastburn in Erin's bed. Lying beneath a Star Wars blanket, she stared blankly at the ceiling. Her throat was also slashed to the point of almost decapitation, and like her mother, she had multiple stab wounds to her chest. Word spreads quickly in small towns, and Fayetteville is no different. But this horrific crime scene immediately called back memories of a cold, raw February night 15 years earlier, when another mother and her 2 children were brutally murdered. But they had lived on base in married housing with their husband and father, Captain Jeffrey McDonald. The Eastburn case has always fascinated me in its connection to the McDonald case. Others dispute or dismiss this connection, but investigators at the time didn't, nor did the community, so I still find it relevant. The McDonald case is still so interesting because, while it's difficult to believe a man could do that to his family, he did do it. But I am also always compelled that though this was decades before DNA, the blood in the McDonald home still told the secrets. It still outed the monster in Jeffrey McDonald. And I believe the same is true for the murderer of the Eastburn girls, only this time, technology caught up with the killer. Completely different motives, obviously, but so many other coincidences. 2 young military wives and their 2 daughters, close in the same ages, were murdered in their homes in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There is even a drug-addicted young woman inserting herself into both cases. However, that's really where the comparisons end. To begin with, though, the McDonalds were murdered on the military base, so the first investigation was handled by the Army. In the Eastburn case, the family lived off base, so the first investigation and the prosecution was handled by the Cumberland County District Attorney, and so was the second, but not the third. In both cases, the Army has acted questionably and been publicly criticized. In the McDonald case, they let a killer go, and it took the tenacity of his dead wife's family to push the case through to federal court to finally convict Jeffrey McDonald 10 years later. In the Eastburn murders, the DA had its bite at the apple twice and lost. But when DNA evidence finally evolved enough and linked their suspect to the crimes, they were out of chances, so the Army put him on active duty just to try him and sentence him to death. I'll let you make up your own mind how you feel about that. I know how I feel, and I'll present evidence for both sides. But ultimately, this case is a matter of opinion because when it comes to the Constitution, even the experts disagree on the ethics. But let's go back to the beginning and see how a man could be tried 3 times for the same crime. Cumberland County Sheriff Otis Jones put Detective Jack Watts, head of the homicide unit, and Detective Robert Biddle, along with 2 other detectives, on the case full-time. The sheriff, in the middle of a bid for re-election, did not want an unsolved triple murder case hanging over his campaign. Aside from Watts and Biddle, and 2 other full-time detectives assigned to the case, Sheriff Jones had 27 other detectives pooling their sources, and 7 agents from the State Bureau of Investigation were called in to help. The sheriff's first priority was proving there was absolutely no connection to the McDonald case. As soon as the murders were discovered, the panicked small-town whispering began. Was this a copycat? Was McDonald really innocent, as he'd always claimed? No one in law enforcement believed he was innocent, but they also couldn't promise this wasn't a copycat crime. Sheriff Jones was hell-bent to prove the Eastburn murders had nothing to do with the McDonald murders. From the get-go, investigators were surprised at the lack of blood at the crime scene, especially considering the gruesome state of the bodies. This was a vicious, messy attack. Luminol soon answered that big question. The killer had gone to great lengths to clean up the scene. There were luminol reactions in the bathroom, on doorknobs, light switches, and footprints all through the small home, and a bloody bath towel was found near the master bedroom door. Detective Watts started interviewing witnesses, and he began with Julie the babysitter. He asked her if anything unusual had happened while she'd been babysitting in the days leading up to the murder. She told him about a few prank phone calls, which had started when Gary Eastburn left for officer school. Katie Eastburn had even told her how to deal with them, and Julie said she didn't seem worried about them. She also mentioned a lady named Angela who called about the Eastburn's dog. Gary and Katie were worried that their beloved dog Dixie would not survive the quarantine required for the move to England. Katie had placed an ad in the classified section of the newspaper to sell the dog, just a small $10 price tag in hopes of serious inquiries, and Julie had taken a call from a woman named Angela about it. Julie told Detective Watts that she put the message on the bulletin board, so he went and checked but found no messages. He asked Julie if she could remember any of the messages in detail, and she said that she couldn't, but she'd actually just given him the first real clue. Unfortunately, the next words out of her mouth were, "It freaks me out. It's just like Dr. McDonald." He listened for a little while as she told of her friendship with Dr. McDonald and went on and on about how he was really innocent and the two had been exchanging letters for a couple of years. Evidently, Julie had read Fatal Vision, 7 times actually, and yet she didn't come away with the same feelings most people have about Jeffrey McDonald. Instead, she became a groupie. He had many, probably still does. It's not uncommon, as we know. He was the type of good-looking, charismatic sociopath that somehow summons blind devotion. But Detective Watts quickly dismissed Julie, not wanting to waste any more time. The investigation went on into the late hours of the night. Shortly after midnight, a young African-American man named Patrick Cone was standing on a hill up the street watching the scene. Though very scared to get involved, he couldn't stand it any longer. He waved down detectives and told them what he had seen on that early Friday morning. At around 3:30 a.m., he had seen a very tall white man wearing jeans, a knit cap, and a black members-only jacket, leaving the Eastburn's driveway with a garbage bag slung over his shoulder. Cone, a janitor whose shift started that day at dawn, was walking along Summerhill Road after leaving his girlfriend's house. Cone nodded nervously at the man he saw, and the man put his head down and mumbled something like, "I'm getting an early start this morning," as he headed in the opposite direction. When Cone stopped and turned around, he saw the taillights of a white Chevette glow before the car pulled away. Patrick Cone was scared, but not of the man he had seen. He was scared because of his drinking, his reputation, the fact that he'd been walking alone after 3 a.m., which meant, of course, that he didn't really have an alibi. But he was sure of what he saw. He was specific in his details, and Watts fully believed him. He was taken to the station to meet with a police sketch artist. I will post the sketch along with a picture of Timothy Hennis on my social media. You will see the resemblance is uncanny. This was before the news hit the papers, before there were any suspects, before they had even followed up the lead on Dixie the dog. 27-year-old Army Staff Sergeant Tim Hennis was home with his wife Angela and their 2.5-month-old daughter Christina when Angela heard on the news that the police were searching for a man who came and bought a dog from Katie Eastburn. Specifically, they described a white man driving a white Chevette that picked up Dixie on the evening of Tuesday, May 7, 1985. The Hennesses not only owned a white Chevette, but Tim was definitely the man who had come and adopted Dixie. Tim dropped his sandwich he was making and turned pale as his wife, who had been following the story of the murders intently, turned around and stared at him. Tim Hennis was adopted at birth by Bob and Mary Lou Hennis, along with his younger brother and sister, who were all adopted within a 3-year span. They grew up fairly affluent in Minnesota with a pool, ping pong table, and horses, and they all enjoyed the outdoors with a Minnesotan gusto, ending each week by never missing a service at the Episcopalian Church. Tim and Angela had eloped right before Christmas in 1982 after Tim's brother Andy had been killed in a motorcycle accident. Tim didn't feel right about having a big celebration so soon after Andy's death. A couple of years later, baby girl Christina was born in February, and the Hennesses flew to Fayetteville to meet both the baby and Angela's family for the first time that Easter. Tim and Angela had a dog named Snowball who wasn't taking to the new baby well at all. They were considering getting another dog to keep Snowball happy when they saw Katie Eastburn's ad in the paper about Dixie. Angela called Katie and asked if her husband could come by and see the dog, and Katie agreed. This was Tuesday, May 7th, 2 days before the murders. When Angela and Tim saw the news, they knew he had to go turn himself in for questioning. So they went down to the police station and waited patiently in the hallway. As Detective Watts was returning from lunch, he saw Tim Hennis in the hall and his jaw dropped. He was a dead ringer for the composite sketch the police artist had drawn from Patrick Cohn's description. The blonde, 6'4", hulking man had a mustache and sleepy eyes with flared nose, just as Patrick had said. Watts had asked Tim to sign a waiver of his Miranda rights, and Tim said, "Before I do this, I need to know if I'm a suspect." Watts told him he wasn't, but they needed to rule him out because he was one of the last people to see Katie Eastburn alive. To the detective, Tim's body language and attitude seemed hostile. But Tim went in willingly, was fingerprinted, gave hair, saliva, and blood samples. He told them how he had gone and met Katie and liked the dog Dixie, so he took her with him. He confirmed that it was the Tuesday before the murders, and he insisted that he hadn't seen her since. Tim said he had taken his wife and daughter 90 minutes away to Selma on Thursday evening so they could stay and visit with her parents for Mother's Day weekend, as he had CQ duty back at the base. He had then gone home alone and went to bed. So, of course, Detective Watts thought to himself, no alibi. They had surmised that the murders probably happened on Thursday night due to the newspaper starting to pile up on Friday morning. During breaks and questioning, Watts knew he needed to get a photo lineup ready and was pretty confident that Hennis would have a record. Sure enough, there was a 2-year-old mugshot on file for a bounced check. He found mugshots of 5 other blonde males to complete the lineup. While Hennis was with Watts, Detective Robert Biddle tracked down Patrick Cohn and showed him the photo lineup. He positively identified Tim Hennis as the man he saw walking down the Eastburn driveway in the early morning hours of May 10th. Biddle even had him cover up the foreheads on the pictures like they would have been if they had on knit caps, and Patrick still picked out Hennis, saying, "I'm certain that's the man." Biddle came back and told Watts that Cohn had identified Hennis, but they didn't have a warrant yet, so they had to let him go. He had been there for 7 hours. Detective Watts would later say he was difficult to question, noting that Tim Hennis was certainly not a dumb man. Late that evening, with the warrant finally in hand, they went to the Hennis home and arrested him. District Attorney Ed Grannis assigned County Prosecutor William Van Story to the case, and Timothy Hennis was officially charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of rape. As frantic as Gary Eastburn had been when he couldn't reach Katie that Saturday, he was oddly calm when on Sunday one of his fellow officers told him there was a detective on the phone for him. His first question to Jack Watts was, "Are any of them alive?" It startled the detective and reminded him that though Gary Eastburn was out of state, the husband is always a potential suspect, and this case was no different. He told Gary that there had been a death in the family and he needed to come home. Gary asked him who was killed, and Watts wouldn't tell him, just repeating that he needed to get home right away. Gary staggered away from the phone and collapsed. He was surrounded by friends and his commanding officer, but it was the chaplain who picked up the phone receiver and got the only comfort that could be offered to Gary, that baby Jana was still alive. Gary and his roommate drove quickly to the Montgomery airport and then flew back to Fayetteville, Gary sobbing for the entire flight. Gary had met Katie Furnish 11 years earlier at a singles softball game in Westwood, Kansas. At the time, he was working as a shoe salesman in Montgomery Ward. He was immediately attracted to the petite brunette with the ponytail and cutoff jeans. At first, Katie's parents didn't see what she saw in the 25-year-old shoe salesman, but he quickly endeared himself to them, declaring the meals Mrs. Furnish made the best he'd ever eaten, praising the vegetable garden Mr. Furnish worked so hard on. Gary was from Independence, Missouri, and had come from a broken home, his parents divorcing when he was 12. He never got along with his stepfather, but he did have a pretty decent childhood. Playing high school football, he even had a few girlfriends, and led a fairly normal life. He joined the Navy after high school. But it was nothing like what the Furnish family had. Two loving parents, and a household full of kids, with Katie the oldest of four. She was a straight-arrow Catholic schoolgirl who never drank or swore, loved animals, and rode horses at her father's stockyards whenever she could. Gary was entranced with the lovely young woman and charmed by her family life. He would later say, "You know how some people say they want to grow up and be a fireman? I always wanted to grow up and be a husband and father." The Eastburns married a year after they met. By the time Kara, their oldest, was born, Gary had decided to make the military his career. He wanted to be an air traffic controller, so he soon enlisted, and the Eastburns started shuffling around like all military families, finally landing at Fort Bragg, where Jana was born. Now, on that awful plane ride home, that Mother's Day, May 12th, he kept looking at pictures of his family and crying and saying over and over again that he shouldn't have left them. The plane landed around 11 p.m., and Gary immediately asked to be taken to see Jana. But instead, he was taken to the sheriff's department and questioned on his marriage until about 2 a.m. by Detective Watts. He also had to provide blood and hair samples before he could go see his daughter. Jana was at the Womack Army Hospital at Fort Bragg, hooked up to IVs, bags under her eyes, and her teeth were blackened from going without food or water for 3 nights. She didn't recognize her father, and her eyes were still glazed with shock. The doctor told him that had she stayed in that crib another 2 hours, he probably would have lost her too. The next day, Watts asked Gary to go to the house and see what was missing. He had already sorted through their unopened mail, his heart hurting even more as he saw his unopened Mother's Day card that Katie never got to read. He reluctantly agreed to go to the house. During his own interrogation, Watts had already told him how his wife and children were murdered, stabbed, throat slit, and also that Katie had been raped. The brutal smell of blood hit Gary as he walked in, and Watts told him they speculated that the killer had arrived after the girls were in bed, but not too late, as Katie was still in her jeans and blouse and had been folding clothes. She had let the killer in the house. Could it be someone they knew? Gary couldn't imagine anyone wanting to hurt Katie, but he did remember some prank calls from months before that he'd shrugged off at the time. We have to remember that this was long before caller ID or even Star 69. Prank calls were much more commonplace back then. The calls were only frightening because the guy knew Katie's name. Well, actually, he had called her Mrs. Eastburn. But again, this was in the time of everyone having a published phone number in the White Pages. Any creep with a phone book could spook thousands of women in the area. It didn't necessarily mean they were going to actually do any harm. And besides, there were no signs of forced entry. In fact, the crime scene read like Katie had known the man at the door and willingly let him inside. The investigators had tried to cover the bloodstains, but Gary could clearly see them everywhere anyway. The attack on Katie had begun in the living room, where they found her blouse and shoes and a laundry basket overturned. But as Gary walked into his master bedroom, it was clear that Katie had broken free and ran in here, becoming trapped on the other side of the bed. Gary despaired at the pitiful fight Katie must have put up, and hoped desperately that the killer had not made her watch him kill Aaron, who was found on the other side of the bed. He told Watts that it wasn't unusual for Aaron to be in their bed. Katie often put her down to sleep in there so the girls wouldn't stay up giggling together. Then, when Aaron fell asleep, she would be carried to her own bed in the girls' room. The investigators weren't sure who was killed first. Had the girls been awoken by the attack, and the killer went after them first? That could be another reason Katie ran to the bedroom, desperately trying to save her daughter, but becoming trapped and slaughtered in the same room with her. Gary Eastburn couldn't stand being in the house any longer. He told Watts that a metal lockbox that held important family papers was taken, along with $300 in cash that had been saved for Christmas, along with Katie's wallet, which held her bank ATM card. The investigators checked the ATM records and found a witness, Lucille Cook, that made a transaction within minutes of when Katie's card had been used the morning after the murders. She described Tim Hennis perfectly and then picked him out of a lineup. The Army, which had jurisdiction over Hennis, could have court-martialed him on these charges, but crimes committed off-base were generally prosecuted by Cumberland County. So Bob Hennis hired two prominent Fayetteville lawyers, Jerry Beaver and Billy Richardson, to defend his son. They faced a tough task. Several eyewitnesses recalled seeing a white Chevette on Summerhill Road on the evening of the murders. And a neighbor called in to report seeing Hennis burning something in his backyard the Friday morning after the murders would have happened. Then a local dry cleaner called in and said Tim Hennis had brought in a black members-only jacket on Friday, the day after the murders. Also, his landlord called the prosecutor and told them that Tim didn't pay his rent until May 10th, after an eviction notice was sent. He paid the $310 rent, plus a $35 late fee, not even 12 hours after Katie and the girls were murdered and $300 in cash happened to be taken from the home. Seems like folks were lining up to call in suspicious activity on Tim Hennis. And the worst one of all, Hennis's alibi, that he had returned home immediately after dropping off his wife and daughter at his in-laws, was disproven when Nancy Mazur, a former girlfriend, also called in and told detectives a different story. Hennis and Mazur had met years earlier at a honky-tonk bar at Fort Bragg and dated for a while. Even after they broke up, Hennis still occasionally stopped by her house. On May 9th, Hennis, knowing that Mazur's husband was deployed in Germany, made an unannounced visit. Mazur let him in and they talked. She asked how his marriage was going, and Tim told her that Angela had left him. But if he was looking for romance, he got no encouragement, and according to Mazur, who was annoyed by the unsolicited visit, he left around 9 o'clock. The case of Timothy Hennis was just about wrapped up nicely with a bow. But still, you don't rush a triple murder trial, and as the months of investigation dragged on, it was getting close to Christmas, and a bond hearing was scheduled. Judge D.B. Herring allowed Tim Hennis out on a $100,000 bond. This was mainly because the lab tests on the blood and semen evidence had been inconclusive. This didn't exonerate Hennis, but they couldn't rule him out either. In this time before DNA, the best they could do was blood testing. And the victim's blood often masked the killer's blood type, which was exactly what happened in this case. Without physical evidence linking Hennis to the murders, the judge said he couldn't hold him. To Gary Eastburn's horror, he saw Tim Hennis at the mall with his family bouncing his daughter on his shoulders as they did some Christmas shopping. Gary's own daughter, Jana, had stopped developing for about 7 months after the murders, her own language skills frozen in time. But by February, she had begun talking again, and though Gary resisted it, not wanting to further traumatize Jana, and knowing she probably didn't remember anything, Watson Biddle had worn him down. The detectives needed to question the little girl, the only survivor and the only witness. Dr. Helen Brantley, a child psychologist in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, conducted 5 videotaped interviews with Jana. Under questioning, she said her mommy was at work, often rubbing her eyes and kissing her mother's picture. The doctor showed Jana pictures of the house on the 3rd interview, and she became upset. She ran across the room and pulled a beanbag over her head, crying, "Hide from the burglar so he doesn't get us." She told the doctor she had hidden under her blankets and kept saying, "He's going to come get me." Dr. Brantley concluded that Katie or one of the girls had probably come into the room and tried to quiet Jana during the attacks. She also said that Jana was unable to pick the same photograph from the suspect pictures when she was shown them different times, and so she decided to end the interview. Ultimately, there just wasn't enough that Jana remembered to be used at trial. The trial started on May 27, 1986, a little over a year after the murders. Defense attorney Jerry Beaver thought about arguing for a change of venue considering the publicity, but he conducted several phone polls from surrounding areas and found that everyone knew this case anyway. It wouldn't matter. He'd be better off hoping to garner favor with the judge by not suggesting that they move the trial. But a stunt he pulled with Patrick Cohn lost any favors he might have been granted. At a suppression hearing, the defense shocked the judge and prosecutors by announcing that they had taped proof that Patrick Cohn had lied about identifying Tim Hennis. They had gotten Patrick Cohn alone and taped him recanting. Patrick had been having a rough time of it awaiting trial. His father didn't want him getting involved and continuously questioned Patrick about his memory. And finally, under pressure from the 2 defense attorneys and worried about his family and what would happen after the trial, Patrick said maybe he'd made a mistake. While the defense team is supposed to have access to any witnesses, the circumstances of how they went about it were highly suspect. They tracked Patrick down on the street and taped him in a car. The judge called for an immediate recess, and Van Story pulled Patrick Cohn aside and asked him what was on the tape. Patrick swore it was nothing, that he had told the defense the same thing he had told the DA's office. Van Story got Patrick some lunch and left him in a briefing room alone with a notepad. While he was alone for more than an hour, Patrick Cohn wrote a letter to his mother, pouring his heart out to her and promising her that he was doing the right thing even though he was scared. He wrote to her, "I know deep in my heart that the man I picked out of the lineup is the man I saw that night." So basically, he recanted the taped version of the recantation. And whatever trump card Beaver and Richardson thought they had with Patrick Cohn had just evaporated into thin air. Patrick did well on the stand in the first trial. The defense valiantly tried to get him to say he was influenced by the prosecution, but he insisted he was not influenced. Instead, on record, he said, "It's like I know what I saw. I'm the only one out there at 3:30 that morning. I saw the car. I saw Mr. Hennis." But the prosecution did make a few mistakes that would come back to haunt them at the second trial. They had taken a page out of the Fort Bragg duty logbook and kept it, never giving a copy to the defense. This was exculpatory evidence, so it was a big deal. When the defense saw this page, it supported Tim Hennis's claim of being on shift during one of the times that the prosecution said he was using the Eastburn's ATM card. The card was used at 10:52 p.m. on May 11th, making it impossible for Tim to be the one that had used it. But that was Saturday, the second day after the murder. Tim still didn't have an alibi for the night of the murders, and Lucille Cook stood by her story of seeing him at the ATM on Friday, the morning after the murders. Despite a few messy mistakes, a couple tantamount to prosecutorial misconduct, Van Story still pretty much had a home run. Patrick Cohn had not backfired the way the defense thought he would. His other eyewitnesses held up under scrutiny. He had the burn barrel, the coincidental ATM evidence, and he could have closed there. But he wasn't done. He introduced more than 90 pictures into evidence. Evidence the jury had already seen. Except this time, he put it in a slideshow that ran for more than an hour. Gruesome picture after picture, both of the crime scene and autopsies, were shown in court. This was the crucial mistake that led to the Superior Court granting Tim Hennis's appeal for a new trial. And why did they do it? They had it. They had more than enough. Were they just being greedy, or were they just being sure? According to defense attorney Jerry Beaver, they relished in releasing that slideshow. At this point in the trial, anger was definitely simmering between the defense and prosecution. In closing arguments, Van Story drove home the gruesome aspects of the murders by holding up before and after pictures of Kara and Aaron Eastburn and then pointing at Tim Hennis and screaming, "There's your baby killer." At 4:30 on July the 4th, 1986, the jury filed out into the courtroom and found Tim Hennis guilty on all counts. After the verdict, defense attorneys Beaver and Richardson drove around Fayetteville in turn blaming themselves and finding excuses. They had a judge that favored the prosecution, a community that was still incensed from the McDonald trial that was against them from the start, and, of course, a prosecutor who they felt bent the rules. But finally, they had to see their own mistakes, not moving for a change of venue, not putting Hennis on the stand, because for all the circumstantial evidence and coincidences, they actually had a decent defendant. He was a military man. He was steadfast in his own innocence, and he had his entire family behind him, including his wife, who had had to listen to testimony of her husband's infidelity, and she was still standing by her man. They also regretted the jury selection process. Apparently, they thought that law and order or military-type jurors would never convict a hard-working, law-abiding soldier, and so they never used the peremptory challenges on them. They failed to recognize the intelligence and experience of this type of juror, that they could cut through the rhetoric and grandstanding and see the evidence for what it was. While circumstantial, it was extremely damning. The state had numerous eyewitnesses. No alibi, the burn barrel, the jacket taken to be cleaned the day after the murders, the exact amount of money needed for late rent stolen from the house, the ATM card witness, the uncanny police sketch from Patrick Cohn's memory, before Tennis was even a person of interest, and of course, the biggest coincidence of all, Tim Hennis admittedly had met Katie Eastburn when he came to the house and bought their dog Dixie. But the defense still had a job to do. And that job was to save Tim Hennis's life. He was convicted, but now they were in the sentencing phase. They tread lightly, only having Tim's dad testify to his son's innocence and the impact it had on their family. Not passing around a sweet family picture of Tim, Angela, and Christina, fearing that it would seem like an obvious sympathy ploy, which it would have, and it would not have helped anyway. Because Van Story did not let up. He passed around the worst autopsy and crime scene photos again, doubling down on the jury's sympathies and doubling down on his biggest mistake. The jury only deliberated 3 hours before returning 3 death verdicts. Just days after being booked into Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, Tim Hennis received a postcard from a mysterious Mr. X that read, "Dear Mr. Hennis, I did the crime, I murdered the Eastburns, sorry you're doing the time. I'll be safely out of North Carolina when you read this. Thanks, Mr. X." Both Hennis's attorneys and the prosecutors wrote it off as a hoax. It would be brought up in the second trial, though, and hoax or not, it certainly didn't help the prosecution. During that time, Tim's parents were stricken with worry and did everything they could to help him, including selling their house and not giving each other birthday or Christmas presents. They moved closer so their once-a-month visit wouldn't be such a long trip. Bob also lost his job at IBM. He was embarrassed, but because he had been such a good employee for so long, he did receive a large severance check. However, the early retirement cut his benefits in half. Angela was suffering as well. She was able to visit Tim weekly, but it was hard on her, and she was on welfare, unable to find work in Fayetteville, much less hold her head up in town as the wife of a convicted murderer. At one point, Tim told her she should divorce him and move on with her life. This made her angry, and she told him to stop being a jerk and that she wasn't going anywhere. Tim Hennis's attorneys appealed the case to the North Carolina Supreme Court on grounds that the jurors had been unduly prejudiced by the introduction into evidence of the graphic murder scene photographs. In 1988, the state Supreme Court granted Hennis a new trial based on the prejudicial nature of the explicit crime scene and for the autopsy photos being shown repetitively to the jury. The prosecution could have shown just a handful of the 90 photographs to illustrate the gravity of the crime. To this day, defense attorneys use this ruling to limit the presentation of graphic photographs that could potentially prejudice jurors. And now, the prosecution had essentially been kneecapped before the retrial. In the 3 years before Hennis was granted a new trial, District Attorney Grannis had lost his original prosecution team. The investigators had moved on, and Van Story was now in private practice. D.A. Grannis assigned John Dixon and Calvin Collier, the top two assistant D.A.s in his office. And while they were respected professionals, they had inherited a case with many problems it didn't have the first time around. One of the best eyewitnesses at the first trial, neighbor Margaret Tillison, who identified both Hennis and his white Chevette, had passed away. And now, the CQ logbook could be used to help support defense witnesses, fellow soldiers who swore that Hennis was on duty during the times of both the ATM withdrawals. They still had Lucille Cook's testimony of seeing Hennis at the ATM, but the defense could and did make a good case that Mrs. Cook could have been mistaken. By the time investigators had found her, Tim Hennis's face had been all over the papers and the news. And Van Story's decision to withhold the CQ log evidence in the first trial became an egregious error, leading to reasonable doubt on the ATM evidence. Of course, lead prosecutor Dixon also knew better than to overdo it with graphic pictures this time around. They did still have one thing going for them, and that was Tim Hennis's lack of alibi. There was no one able to corroborate his story of simply going home after leaving Nancy's house that night. However, this time, Beaver and Richardson did not make the same mistake about a change of venue. The trial was moved to Wilmington, a coastal town about 90 miles from Fayetteville. Folks in Wilmington wouldn't know who Tim Hennis was or remember the Eastburn murders, nor did they care. The locals considered this a Fayetteville problem, nothing for their small vacation town to worry about. Plus, Beaver and Richardson had the advantage of knowing the case inside and out, and they rushed to court this time. Grannis, probably overconfident about his evidence, agreed to moving the trial and rushing the court date. What did he really have to worry about? Sure, there were some witness problems, but the most compelling evidence still stood as far as he knew. The original trial verdict was only overturned because of the prejudicial slideshow of graphic photographs. How could they lose now? Well, for 3 years, Hennis's lawyers had been working on how they could undermine the state's case. At the retrial in Wilmington, they focused on discrediting Patrick Cohn. In court, Beaver referred to him as a thief and a liar. Between the first and second trials, Cohn had committed several criminal offenses. He'd tried to use a stolen ATM card, got popped for public drunkenness, and was caught driving without registration. He reportedly told one cop, "You can't arrest me. You need to check with your district attorney, man. They know me, and I'm their witness." All of these charges against Patrick Cohn were dismissed. So naturally, Hennis's defense team went after Patrick Cohn with everything they had. However, Detective Jack Watts never doubted Cohn's account. Mr. Cohn had some problems, he said. He was a street kid and he drank, but he didn't have to come forward. To this day, I believe every word he told us. Enough uncertainty was cast on Cohn's testimony, however, to make it largely worthless. But Beaver and Richardson had more. Footprints found outside the house were three sizes smaller than Hennis's shoes. A spot of blood discovered on a bathroom towel did not match Hennis's blood. Investigators had found in the Eastburns' house several hairs, including a pubic hair, that belonged to neither Hennis nor the victims. The house was a rental, and the pubic hair had been found near a couch in the living room, not on Katie Eastburn's body. But the prosecution did little to contest the defense's presentation. Pieces in a crime like this do tend to stick out, and defense attorneys smartly grasp at them. But a smart prosecutor could have made these issues less important in contrast with the mountain of circumstantial evidence they still had on Tim Hennis. As for the fire that Hennis set in his backyard after the murder, the defense asserted that nothing in the charred remains had been traced to the Eastburn home. And not only did Hennis's members-only jacket lack bloodstains, an analyst from the International Fabric Care Institute testified that Varsol, the chemical used in dry cleaning, could not remove all traces of blood. But who's to say he actually kept the jacket on during the attacks? Maybe he took it off, and there was no blood. The dry cleaner only remembered seeing dog hair on it. And Patrick Cohn said he saw him with a garbage bag slung over his shoulder. Maybe it contained the clothing that had blood stains that could be linked back to Hennis. But Richardson had told the jury, "You have physical evidence crying out to you, just absolutely crying out to you that he is not the man. You've got the pubic hair in there that ain't him. They are putting a doggone square peg in a round hole and it doesn't fit, and it stinks." 2 days later, the jury reached a verdict. Not guilty on all counts. To a devastated Gary Eastburn, the new prosecution team had barely put up a fight. Their hearts weren't in this case the way Van Story's had been. They also seemed to share the disdain that Hennis's own defense attorneys had for the state's star witness, Patrick Cohn. They did little to combat the character attack on Cohn at the second trial, nor did they try and prepare him for his second time testifying now that over 3 years had passed. Cohn had been in a lot of trouble, and it didn't look great, but there were other eyewitnesses that backed up his description of Tim Hennis. But they didn't do this. They didn't do any of it. I hate to think they didn't care. I rather think they didn't have enough time to properly prepare for a case of this magnitude. Their boss, District Attorney Granis, was overly confident in his original evidence. He treated this trial like a slam-dunk rerun, even without the final slideshow to incense the jury. They should have gone back over all of the evidence. They should have prepared rebuttal arguments for the shoe prints and hair. They should have worked harder to prepare Patrick Cohn. They should have apologized for Van Story's stunt with the CQ logbook and proposed another theory for the ATM evidence. They should not have underestimated Beaver and Richardson, who wanted to win so desperately this time. And when they did, after 3 years on death row, Tim Hennis walked out a free man into the open arms of his wife and family. Following his acquittal, Timothy Hennis re-enlisted in the Army, despite a 1987 ruling that granted the military greater jurisdiction over civilian crimes, making it possible that he could be court-martialed. Promoted to staff sergeant, he did tours of duty in Saudi Arabia and Somalia before being stationed back in the States at Fort Lewis, Washington. Now, the Fifth Amendment ensures that no citizen can be put on trial twice for the same offense. However, double jeopardy only pertains to a specific judicial realm. State courts and federal courts represent distinct sovereigns, and under the dual sovereign doctrine in the Constitution, a defendant can be tried and acquitted in state court and then tried again for the same crime in federal court. It doesn't happen often. The Justice Department usually practices extreme restraint with this law. When they do invoke the dual sovereign law, it often involves civil rights. After a jury acquitted four Los Angeles police officers in the beating of Rodney King, U.S. attorneys charged them for the same offense in federal court, and two of them were convicted. Moreover, for the Hennis case anyway, Army regulations state that a person subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, who has been tried in a civilian court, may but ordinarily will not be tried by court-martial. In 1987, a soldier named Ronald Gray appeared in a North Carolina court and pled guilty to two murders and multiple rapes. Despite the fact that he received consecutive life sentences, the Army court-martialed Gray, charging him with 2 additional murders and several rapes, securing a death sentence. Colonel Mike Mulligan, the head of the Army's appellate division, said at the time, "In the Army, justice does not have a price." Many legal scholars contend that the Army violates the spirit of the Constitution's prohibition on double jeopardy. Critics say that it's particularly problematic when it's used to prosecute members of the military for crimes committed in the civilian world. After American troops invaded Mexico in 1846, General Winnifred Scott expanded the military's jurisdiction over its soldiers into the civilian world in order to hold them accountable for crimes in Mexican villages and towns. The military maintained this authority well into the 20th century. Then in 1969, the Supreme Court ruled that military jurisdiction must be confined to service-connected crimes. The precedent lasted just 18 years. In 1987, the court, newly under the leadership of William Rehnquist, expanded the Uniform Code of Military Justice, restoring the military's authority to prosecute all sorts of crimes committed by its personnel. Either way, Major Rob Stell, of the Army Judge Advocate General Corps, which worked on the Hennis case, told the CNN show Death Row Stories that the military's ability to prosecute a case that has already been tried is, quote, well-settled law. Nothing the state does actually affects what the federal government can do. CNN legal expert and author Jeffrey Toobin said, in a very narrow category of cases where the federal government believes an injustice has been done, the federal prosecutors will step in. Now, as promised, I will give you my opinion on the ethics of the double jeopardy in this case. I don't have a problem with it, because Tim Hennis was in the Army at the time of the murders, which according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice would make the crime under their jurisdiction. The mistake was that the Army didn't prosecute Hennis in the first place. They let Cumberland County take the case, most likely still feeling the burn of lasting criticism for their mishandling of the McDonald case. And the even bigger mistake was allowing Hennis to go free in the second trial, and that blame is largely on the first prosecution team for withholding evidence. But beyond errors and bad judgment by the Cumberland DA's office, let's talk more about the legality of the court-martial. Beyond the dual sovereign law and the Constitution, I really feel that the Hennis case is a good example of the Uniform Code of Military Justice working the way it is supposed to. Hennis was on active duty when he committed crimes against another officer's family. To me, under our dual sovereign law, as well as the Army's Uniform Code of Military Justice, Timothy Hennis lost his right to double jeopardy. I do hope with the controversy surrounding this case that the military will reconsider letting civilian courts handle crimes that really should be under their jurisdiction. And I also hope local prosecutors learned a hard lesson. You can't hide evidence and cut corners no matter how sure you are. They let a guilty man walk free for 20 years because they chose to break the rules. But back to our timeline with the court-martial. With legal loopholes aside, the military still had all of the circumstantial evidence, and now they had DNA. In 2005, 20 years after the Eastburn murders, a homicide detective in Cumberland County pulled the sperm evidence out of storage and sent it to a state lab for testing. According to the forensic biologist, the semen sample was 1.2 quadrillion times more likely to belong to Tim Hennis than any other white man in North Carolina. However, the state crime lab that did the DNA testing soon became caught up in a major scandal. In 2010, across the country, state crime labs were being investigated. With new DNA technology exonerating so many people, the labs came under greater scrutiny, and North Carolina's lab was one of the biggest scandals uncovered. Over a 16-year period, analysts at the state crime lab systematically withheld or distorted evidence in an attempt to secure convictions in at least 230 cases, including 10 in which the defendants were sentenced to death, and 3 that resulted in executions. But the DNA lab in North Carolina was not involved in this investigation. Only the trace evidence lab was, which means that the technicians that dealt in hair and fiber evidence were the only ones involved. Many people believe that the scandal casts reasonable doubt on any DNA cases as well, but this was not brought up in the court-martial. Also, the defense did have some of the evidence privately tested, but the details have never been released. This could be because the tests were inconclusive, not that they showed guilt. But still, if you roll the dice and have it tested, not releasing the results is definite egg on your face. And military prosecutors had the second smear from the rape kit tested. They sent it to a military lab, and it did match Hennis. The military lab found the match to Hennis to be a 12 billion to 1 chance that it was from another white male. That is a positive ID, obtained separately from the North Carolina lab scandal. I am not going to go back over the entire court-martial. As one of the new military prosecutors, Captain Nathan Huff, pointed out, the only real difference between this trial and the previous trials was the new DNA evidence. And even though Timothy Hennis hired top military defense attorney Frank Spinner to lead his new team, which included two ranking uniformed attorneys, they could not overcome the mountain of circumstantial evidence and the now smoking gun of DNA. After getting nowhere trying to discredit witnesses or casting doubt on the DNA evidence, the defense resorted to smearing Katie Eastburn as an adulterer, arguing that the sperm could have been there for up to 3 days, leaving time for Katie to have had consensual sex with Tim Hennis. And it didn't work. In fact, I'd say it backfired. The jury, made up of military officers, were offended at the suggestion the defense made that affairs happened all the time, especially when soldiers are on active duty. Also, Tim Hennis has always denied any sexual contact with Katie Eastburn. Now he wants to imply it was consensual? No. And I'm sorry, but the amount of sperm found inside Katie Eastburn would not have still been there 3 days later when she was murdered, even if your mind could handle the mental gymnastics that Tim somehow convinced her to have sex, and then she was murdered by a different man, exactly matching his description, driving his exact car. I have no doubt in my mind that he was guilty, and neither did the military jury. Even though they only needed a two-thirds majority, the entire panel agreed and found Tim Hennis guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced him to death. He's back at Leavenworth to this day awaiting his final sentence. But even after the appeals process is over, Hennis cannot be executed without presidential approval. In recent years, that hasn't happened very often. The U.S. military has not executed anyone from its ranks since 1961. There is one other bit of information I found, which ironically was in the book by Scott Wisnant, who believed Tim Hennis was innocent. Tim was accused of rape in another case from his hometown. Back when the Eastburn murders happened in 1985, a 24-year-old Rochester, Minnesota woman who had read about Tim's arrest in the newspaper in an article titled "Ex-Rochester Men Charged with Rape, Triple Slaying in North Carolina," called the Rochester Rape Crisis Line. She said, "That guy raped me." When she was 11 years old, she was riding her bike home from school and 2 boys stopped her. One of them raped her. This was 13 years before the Eastburn murders. She filed a report, but no arrests were ever made. And Tim Hennis lived just across town from her. During the first trial, she had agreed to travel to Fayetteville to testify against him, but only if Van Story could get her on the stand. Standard evidence rules barred him from bringing in other crimes, but if Tim Hennis were to take the stand, he could ask the question and then call her on rebuttal. I think it's very possible that this is why he didn't testify in the first trial. And the prosecutors in the second trial never even looked into it. It was not brought up in the military court-martial either. But by then, they had more than enough to convict Tim Hennis. Mr. Wisnant has since admitted to feeling conflicted due to the DNA evidence. He stands on the side of those who think it is ethically wrong to try Hennis a third time, but he doesn't feel great about it. I read his book on the case entitled Innocent Victims because I wanted to get a clear look at both sides. The book was published after Tim Hennis's second trial, but before the court-martial. And I think it's to his credit that he presents all of the damning evidence against Temminus. He didn't hold anything back. And he did write a new epilogue after the DNA evidence came out and Hennis was convicted in the court-martial. He is still troubled by the prosecutorial misconduct in the first trial and wary of the DNA testing of the semen sample because the judge ruled that the pubic hair and another stray hair found in Kara's body bag could not be tested. And he was always more swayed by the subplot involving the babysitter Julie Zerniak, who accused everyone from ex-boyfriends to her stepbrothers of being involved. At one point, she even told friends she was in the same room as Katie was being raped. She was a drug addict and a screw-up with an unnatural obsession with Jeffrey McDonald. She wanted to be a part of this case, but she just does not fit in. Much like the ghost of Helena Stokely, the druggie who changed her story so many times in the McDonald case, she's just not credible. Not only do I say that based on her character, but there has never been any evidence to back up any of her claims. And Helena Stokely was mainly a pawn in the McDonald case, too. Never admitting to being there, but being so out of her mind on LSD the night of the murders that she wasn't sure where she was. Her character and addiction issues were used by McDonald's defense team, but ultimately, it did not work. Hennis's defense team was too smart to try and use Julie the same way, no matter how hard she tried to insert herself into the case. But Timothy Hennis, like Jeffrey McDonald, was pulled back by the ghosts in his past. Technology finally caught up to him. Some people have trouble with the fact that he remained an outstanding soldier and an upstanding citizen after the Eastburn murders, but I think 3 years on death row might scare anyone straight. And aside from the other rape accusation, Tim Hennis was no saint. He had multiple arrests for bad checks, and while that alone doesn't make him a murderer, there was also a violent altercation at his second job at Bennigan's shortly before the murders. I think his defense team did a good job of burying this, and it was inconsequential enough that the prosecutors didn't think they needed it. But I do think it shows Tim Hennis to be a hothead at the very least. And there were also whispers that he wasn't lying to Nancy that night. He wasn't just dropping off Angela to spend time with her parents. She was possibly going to leave him. There were many pressures on the young marriage. Money, a new baby. Tim was having to work two jobs to keep up. But for whatever reason, she chose to stand by him, as did his family. Both of their parents and one of her grandparents even mortgaged their homes to put up the money for Tim's bond. But maybe, despite all of their problems, Angela just couldn't believe her husband was capable of murder. And I'm not even sure he went there with the intent to annihilate the Eastburn girls. I think Tim Hennis went to his ex-girlfriend Nancy's house that night wanting sex. She said he was pissed at Angela, and then, of course, she spurned his advances. And then Tim thought back to the pretty Katie Eastburn. She had called him earlier in the day to check on how Dixie was doing. So he went to her house and talked his way in. She wouldn't have been scared of the man that she'd let adopt her beloved pet, much less another soldier like her husband. But when she said no, he pulled a knife on her. Ligature marks were found on her wrists, the buttons on her shirt were found in the living room, and her jeans were yanked off. Her bra and underwear were cut off with a knife. The main attack and rape occurred in the living room. I think the Eastburn daughters did wake up. I think Kara went to her baby sister's crib and tried to make her be quiet so they wouldn't be discovered, and then hid in her sister's bed underneath Aaron's blanket. I think poor 3-year-old Aaron Eastburn hid under the covers in her mother's bed, frozen in fear. She had no defensive wounds on her hands or arms, too young to even understand what was happening to her. But Kara did have defensive wounds. She at least put up her arms to ward off the knife. I think when Katie broke free is when Tim lost control, and what began as an assault turned deadly. She ran, but she had nowhere to go. Maybe she ran to protect Aaron, or maybe she was just running for her life. Either way, she became trapped on the other side of that bed, and that is where he slit her throat. He didn't just slit her throat, he hacked it to shreds. And he did the same thing to her daughters. Aaron was nearly decapitated from the force. I think at this point, he was not only enraged, but frantic to stop their screaming. Most of the stab wounds on all three were post-mortem, almost an afterthought. It was the vicious hacking at their necks that silenced them forever. And that's all I have for you on this unusual case. A case where double jeopardy was trumped by a loophole in military and federal law. And that loophole brought justice, finally, to the Eastburn family. And you may not agree with me. That's fine, too. We are all entitled to our own opinions, and personal ethics are just that, personal. But I truly think the third time's the charm for this guy, and I don't feel the least bit conflicted that he's sitting on death row. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. If you like the show, please tell a friend or write and review on iTunes. I'm also on Google Play and Stitcher and many other podcast platforms. If you're interested in supporting the show, I am now on Patreon. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Southern Fried True Crime if you'd like to connect with me there. Thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.